My favorite is birds aren't real.
Okay.
I like that
That's
one.
That's a solid one.
Yeah.
Did you know that you can make more money by merge mining other networks? Check out makemoremoneymining.com for information on BIPs 300 and 301, a proposal to bring more revenue to Bitcoin miners through sidechains and merge mining called drive chains. Increase your mining revenues and learn more about participating in Bitcoin governance by visiting makemoremoneymining.com. Are you a miner who wants to activate Bitcoin improvements? Check out activation.watch. See what Bitcoin improvements the Bitcoin community, developers, and miners are considering and show support by signaling for one of many BIPs up for consideration. Activation.watch. Is your mining operation happening ready? Take control of your own future with the right energy strategy. Linkcoin Energy Trading Platform is a tool used by miners to design, monitor, and seamlessly orchestrate sophisticated energy strategies within electricity markets such as ERCOT, New York, and PJM. Avoid penalties, participate in demand response programs, and capture hundreds of thousands of dollars per megawatt per year by deploying the right block and index strategy. Secure your competitive edge at linkcoin.com. Are you a retail or institutional investor interested in Bitcoin mining companies? The Miner Mag brings you free data and analysis from all major NASDAQ-listed Bitcoin mining operations to know who stands out. Check out visualized metrics and data-dependent stories at theminermag.com.
Welcome to the Mining Pod, Pub Key Edition. Drew Thomas joining us this morning, talking about, surprise, Bitcoin mining. Guys, welcome to the show. Drew, it's been like 2 years since I've had you on. You probably thought I was going to have you on all the time.
No, it certainly has been an eventful 2 years, but yeah, no, I think we did that. I did that pod from the living room of an apartment whose couch I was crashing on at the time.
So nothing's it's nice. Changed either, huh?
Nothing's changed. It's nice to be in more beautiful, scenic, vibey climes here at PubKey.
Yeah, just a dungeon bar to talk about some Bitcoin mining.
That's what we're here for. And Thomas is on the show. Never gave you an invitation. I had to fly out here and get you. Get you in front of a mic. But okay, we're going to jump into mostly Bitcoin mining from an overview perspective for 2023, and then also talk about like what's happening right now with Bonk, because we had to start there.
You want to talk about Bonk?
We do, and you have to disclose your personal holdings.
I have some Bonk.
Elaborate.
I have to tell you how much Bonk I have?
Yeah, you do.
Yes.
Now, Bonk is up a lot this morning. It's up 797%.
All right, so Bonk is a dog coin on Solana that was airdropped when Solana was like completely dead.
Yeah.
Right? Because Solana was effectively just the aspects of Solana were being used like Binance Smart Chain from FTX perspective. So when FTX went under, I think a lot of people just assumed that like Solana was going to be forever dead. Nothing ever dies in this ecosystem.
No.
So they airdropped this dog coin, which is the horny doge, Bonk. And it had like a big pop, and then it was like nothing for a while, but Solana's been on a tear, and Bonk has been on a pretty epic tear. Today is particularly funny because it's a confluence of two things. So it got listed on Coinbase, but everybody's fucking terrified to touch their ledgers today because of the ledger exploit that was released, I think, earlier this morning.
Jeez.
So there's like a squeeze, I guess, of Bonk. There's a Bonk squeeze. We don't have to go into it anymore.
I mean, don't
dwell on it for a moment, at least.
Honestly, you shouldn't have any money in cash, Bitcoin, or you know anything else that you're not willing to lose. I feel like Bonk, this sounds like the people's dog coin, is the one thing I found out when I read the website for 5 seconds before we did this podcast. But I'm devastated to hear about this Ledger exploit.
Ledger.
Hate to see it.
It's like one thing after another with Ledger. It's like...
It's tough. Do you guys use them?
I have a Ledger. I don't use it.
I have one too.
I wouldn't put any Bitcoin on it. It's got my Bonk.
Mine has Bitcoin on it. So if you're listening to the show, you can exploit me right now.
No, I think the problem so far, I think, with the Ledger exploit has been specifically Ethereum dApps. So it hasn't spread to Solana yet. I don't think that it has any issues with Bitcoin specifically, not that I've seen yet.
Yeah.
But I think that there is a lot of anxiety around exactly what's happening. And this comes on the back of a lot of problems that Ledger's had between Ledger Live, you know, phoning home about everything. Releasing personal information of where people live if they've ever bought a ledger and had it shipped.
Yeah.
These are not necessarily the things that you want to see out of a privacy and hardware wallet device. Like this is like, you know, precisely the opposite. Yeah. And I don't think that they've cleaned it up in post terribly well. Hopefully they do better. I root for all these companies to do well because, you know, their success, is accretive to, you know, the broader ecosystem and Bitcoin specifically.
Yeah.
It's not great.
Have you seen the Eric Wall posts about what's happening in Sweden right now with the attacks on people, physical attacks?
No.
You guys haven't?
No.
That's surprising. Okay, so this ties into what you're talking about with Ledger, right? They accidentally gave away information for people who had purchased and shipped Ledgers to their addresses. And why that matters is...
Was this the one from multiple years ago? Because there was a similar leak, I want to say back in 2019, 2020.
Yeah, that's the one I'm referencing.
That's the original one, yeah.
And so like why it matters, we're kind of seeing right now with Sweden. Sweden has really odd laws around some of its... I think it's information if you are like arrested for a crime, they'll put your information into a public database. And anyone who's had like their assets been put out there by the state, now you can kind of like link those two together because it's all on record and public and open to anybody. And Eric was just going through now tweeting about all these horrific stories of people who are being identified as holding crypto and people are breaking their homes, breaking their kneecaps and just taking them apart. Because they know there's crypto there. It's digital cash. You stake it.
So, I don't know. The $5 rent attack is definitely, you know, that's been a thing for Bitcoiners for a while now. People have other assets too, right? People hold gold. They have jewelry. Yeah. Like, you know, I think that, you know, this is a phenomenon that will probably continue to play out. But I don't think it's specific. Let me put it this way.
He's not sympathetic to the rent attacks.
What is the total amount of rent attacks that are specific to crypto?
Yeah.
Right? Like burglaries. Like, do we think that burglaries that are specifically targeting, crypto holders are 1%, 5%?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. You got to stay safe out there.
And unfortunately, there's really not much that can be done about it. I mean, it kind of goes to show that KYC can be very dangerous just because it creates these, you know, data honeypots. And anytime you have a data honeypot, it can lead to exploitation like this. I think that's what's most relevant to people in the U.S. here. But... you know, at the end of the day, it kind of is what it is, and that's why you need to take your OPSEC important and try to do what you can to protect yourself and your family.
All good thoughts.
I feel safe in the city. Safety in crowds.
In New York, you're safe because, there's so many people. You don't know if you're just... they got so many folks who might be very close to our location right now. Just, you know...
All right. Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's move on.
Let's leave that world. There's good thoughts on New York, bunk, and wrench tax. Okay, for Bitcoin mining, we haven't lost the crowd yet. Let's talk about this year. Hash price is up. Hash rate is up. Ordinals are up. That's what we got Drew here to kind of delve into some of that public information since you're at Cathedra.
What's hash rate at now? 510?
Yes. 509 when I checked a couple days ago.
So I'm looking at hash rate index right now, and we are at 108 per petahash as of... this moment
for hash price,
yeah, 108 per petahash, which is the highest in definitely 3 months, maybe even a little longer. It's not quite the yearly high. The yearly high was back in May.
Yeah, that was like the ordinal Eiffel Tower, though. That was just like a 2 week spike,
a quick moment.
Yeah.
This one's a little
maybe
more sustained.
Weeks,
like,
actually,
I don't know what the average is looking at this, but like eyeballing is probably between like 75 and 80 over the last 2 months, which is a much healthier position. And we're seeing like some of these older ASICs now, like beginning series S19 models, are profitable again and making like $3 to $7, somewhere in that. Drew, how is this affecting you guys at Cathedra?
Yeah, so it's interesting when you have these largely TX fee-driven pumps in hash price. But I guess maybe first to zoom out a little bit more. I think every month we have a Bitcoin mining meetup here at PubKey. We started that for the first time back in January of this year. We had Ed Evenson and Daniel Frumkin, formerly of Brains, who joined us. And so every month when we do a meetup here, we kind of start out by actually looking at the hash rate index and then, you know, walking through some of these statistics. And I think this year has been interesting because obviously, you know, Bitcoin is now nearly 3x to where it was a year ago. When we saw, you know, 15K last year and, you know, even ending the year, I believe, below 20K. It's interesting because over the course of this year, obviously Bitcoin's gone up, but network hash rate has just gone, you know, up even more so. And so, you know, thinking about like 500 exahash, if you were talking about 500 exahash, you know, 2 years ago, that would seem insane. And it has been very surprising because anytime Bitcoin price has gone up, for the most part, network hash rates just, you know, caught up and ground it back down. So for the most part, we've really been range bound between like, you know, $60 a petahash and honestly like $90 a petahash for this entire year. Obviously, with Bitcoin pumping up to 40, above 40K, we have seen a recent pump. And this is far more, this looks like there's a little more stability in this pump of hash price versus the one earlier this year. I believe it was around April, May, where you saw the BRC20 pump, where transaction fees went to over 100% of the block subsidy. And I think that's the all-time high there at around, you know, $120 a petahash. But it's interesting now because you saw this concurrent pump in Bitcoin price while also seeing another pump in transaction fees. And so, yeah, I think it's very interesting. It definitely feels like the sentiment's changed from miners' standpoint. You know, miners have been, especially the large miners, have been continuing to plug in machines. The manufacturers are still making a ton of machines over the course of this year. But it definitely feels like there's been a strong sentiment shift in this pump in the last month where miners are, you know, not even just like the largest miners, even small miners, private companies are trying to deploy hash rate now, even though we've just seen this, you know, a new announcement of new generation of machines that's going to lead to an even higher hash rate going into the halving. So it's a very interesting time, I'd say, on the whole, and miners are definitely enjoying some relief.
You guys going to buy S21s?
I don't disclose any MNPI. I think there's a strong case to be made against buying ASICs at this point in time. I think, especially if you think about the Bitcoin denominated returns.
Yeah.
You know, if you price your ASICs in Bitcoin going into a halving, it makes the return profile a little tougher. And then on top of that too, even if you think Bitcoin price is going to pump after the halving, okay, great, but that just means network hash rate is going to pump up even more. So I think if what you really just want is like pure clean Bitcoin exposure, I think there's a solid case to be made that even now that things are looking optimistic and rosy, you might just be better off buying Bitcoin and having the optionality to sell in the future.
Okay, let's talk about ordinals and inscriptions a little bit. I have another shitcoiner with me on the podcast, Thomas. He's buying Bonk and Solana NFTs.
I did not buy Bonk. I've never bought Bonk.
It was airdropped Bonk, and he took it.
I haven't done anything.
A pure Bitcoiner just would have not touched it.
It's rude to say no to a gift, but no, I mean, a pure Bitcoiner would have...
This is your thing.
A laser-eyed Maxi, such as myself, probably would not have been recipient of the airdrop in the first place. But, you know, I'm having fun staying poor. I thought your tweet today was fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
The feeling of buying Bitcoin during alt season, it's not about the money.
It's not. It's about sending a message. But the message here is on-chain because we're inscribing it.
Yeah.
Are you minting anything?
Ordinals are... No. Not really? Not presently. In the beginning, I like to test with things. I don't think I'm like a pure maxi because I actually like to like mess around with new projects.
Your personality, sense of humor.
I like to see what's going on with some of the new stuff that's out there. And I don't do that with everything. But initially with ordinals, I do think ordinals, inscriptions specifically, are very interesting, particularly from like a data preservation perspective, like open time stamps. This is an evolution of open time stamps, Peter Tosh project that's been around for a long time. So the ability to inscribe more robust data sets on the Bitcoin blockchain, I think, has sort of endless applications.
Yeah.
And it starts like the ordinals have never offended me. Like, you know, if people want to inscribe mushroom pictures or monkey gifts or whatever, like, you know, that's fine. Like, if block space has value, it will be used at a certain price.
Yeah.
And that's just what we're seeing sort of play out here. And I think it'll take some time to stabilize. I think people are a bit reactive to this issue and clogging the network. But settlement finality on the Bitcoin blockchain, I believe, is something that is tremendously valuable, and it will be expensive. Like, that's sort of like the natural course of things. And we can argue about whether or not the time is now, or it should be now, or if it prices people out that we don't want to be priced out yet, if the Lightning Network is far along enough, or like whatever. I think that there's a lot of angles to come at this from, but I think the reality is that ordinals are around. They're gonna be for a long time. I think Ocean Pool we should probably get into and discuss a little bit if you guys want to.
We will.
We're gonna see. This is gonna be an evolving conversation, and I think it's important to try and think about lots of different perspectives with this, because there's a wide variety of stakeholders across the entire Bitcoin ecosystem that have different perspectives than other people, and it's not just miners or hodlers or, you know, service providers. There are people who like their monkey pictures.
Let's do a quick aside for those who are wondering what inscriptions really mean. So specifically for BRC20 tokens, the idea here is like you can use part of a Bitcoin block. There's some data in there, and you can add additional data into that section if you want, using like this new idea with ordinals and inscriptions that popped earlier this year. Part of that is this BRC20 standard, where you essentially come up with a token standard that you can fit with inside a Bitcoin block, and that allows other people to mint that token freely. And a lot of people like this aspect of it because anyone can participate in the creation of this token. And then past that, you can also buy and sell and trade these tokens, much like the ERC20 standard on top of Ethereum, which means that we can have more expressivity on Bitcoin than necessarily just sending Bitcoin back and forth. So that's kind of the idea for it. Now, the downside, obviously, is Bitcoin wasn't really built for this, so it's highly inefficient. Ethereum is much more efficient with this, and even they have some problems. Like the ERC20 standard, there's a bunch of things people don't like with it. But for Bitcoin itself...
There's an interesting distinction that I want to make there, though, because, with Ethereum being built for this, it's still calling to somebody else's database, which is, like, housing the information itself, whereas with the Bitcoin blockchain, it sort of accidentally does it way better by inscribing the data, the picture, whatever, into the Bitcoin blockchain. You don't have to do a call to somebody else's, you know, cloud.
Yeah. No, definitely. That's an important part of it. There's different features on both sides of it. I guess the most interesting thing to me right now is like the minting process for creating these BRC20 tokens. It's super simple because there's already some front ends being built. So I've been using like the Unisat wallet to do that this week. You can just go and find a ticker, and it's not fully minted out yet. You can purchase it. You just add like Blue Wallet or whatever wallet you want, any Bitcoin wallet you want, and then you can go and purchase one of these BRC20 tokens. Now, it's completely speculative, right? Like, I bought the Doge ticker this week and the Wizard token this week. I'll probably buy some more. Hopefully, I can flip them for some money. But a lot of people aren't going to like that, right? Like, a lot of people are going to be pretty annoyed that you can do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because... yeah, I mean, the reality is free markets work both ways, right? Like, you know, free markets are a beautiful thing, but it's strange for someone to be pro-free markets and then to be upset with what the free market does. And I think, like, the reality
is... The market wasn't supposed to be used that way. Bunch of, like, crying anarcho-capitalists.
Yeah. The reality is, like, this shit sort of exists. The cat's out the bag, so there's really not that much point... you know, being super upset about it or like complaining about it. Yeah. You know, obviously you can vote with your time and your attention and with what you spend your time working on. And personally, I'm yet to inscribe myself. I almost inscribed Pierre's Everybody's a Scammer. But then I, you know, work on the way and I've procrastinated in that project. But I think the reality is that like, it's also maybe just to tie this into Ocean Pool.
Yeah.
I think what we're seeing right now with ordinals, with BRC20, I also listened to your Spider Chain podcast this morning, and I thought that was very interesting too. But like the reality is that the spam is proliferating at an astonishing rate because this is like an open source protocol that exists. The tooling is out there, and so people are going to build what they can build on it. And if the Bitcoin blockchain, or, you know, if Bitcoin nodes read these transactions as valid transactions, then you know, for me, they're valid transactions.
It is sort of
funny though that Ocean Pool, which, you know, also I learned most of what I know about Ocean Pool from some of your podcasts.
Are you pointing ashrate to Ocean?
We are not pointing ashrate to Ocean, but I think it's interesting because with them now censoring ordinals and inscriptions, censoring inscriptions to be precise, what's really interesting is that they're kind of proving that mining pools are dangerous because they can censor transactions and because they like
precisely.
they're demonstrating the very thing that they were trying to avoid in the first place.
So 2 points on that. By definition, it's not spam. I think that is ridiculous. They're paying for these transactions. They're paying for it to be included into a block. So I think the screeching around this is spamming the network is on a completely like false basis. We can talk about whether or not this is a good use of block space, right? And get into the fundamentals, but it simply is by definition not spam. On the second point, the Ocean Protocol, Ocean Pool, whatever. is really interesting because it uses knots, right? Knots is one of the very first alternative implementations of Bitcoin Core software, which was just the Satoshi reference client. I think knots was second. And I believe it was used initially so that Loop Dash like didn't have to store some gambling activity, like Satoshi Dice, stuff like that. And then a fast follower around the same time was LibBitcoin, Amir Taki's refactoring of the Satoshi reference client. But the entire point of knots was to censor transactions that he did not want to include on his node. So the fact that Ocean Pool is built on knots, like, this is a very deliberate choice, right?
Yeah.
Like, and there is some value to that. I think that, you know, if people don't want to house certain information on their nodes, that's okay. We'll have to see how it plays out. But I think that it is going to be pretty popular as more data gets inscribed on the Bitcoin blockchain. Like, and you can start to think of some nefarious uses that we've talked about here at PubKey, like about a year ago when the ordinals are about a year old now, right?
This is actually the anniversary of the first ordinal being
today.
Created. Today.
Oh, wow.
So kind of cool that we're doing the podcast today. So Rotomore created the first image on his client today. It's like this
the Aztec skull, like the Aztec-y skull thing. Yeah.
Yeah, so I wonder how much that's going for. Okay, I want to do another aside really quickly and talk about the Ethereum ecosystem when they've had issues with implementations or tech changes that they later realized they did not like. So we've seen that with like the suicide contract, if you guys are familiar with that.
I don't know much about the Ethereum protocol
after the
DAO, after they reroute the blockchain.
That's actually a really good example as well. Yes. So like, if we kind of look at these two ecosystems, right, they're trying to like make their chains better, whatever, and they implement tech changes. Bitcoin goes really slow, lots of testing, lots of community consensus. Ethereum goes a little faster. But in both instances, you can have failure, right, where tech leads to something you're not expecting. In this case, with inscriptions. You know, there's an argument that Bitcoin wasn't made for this and it shouldn't be made for this. The Ethereum ecosystem typically has kind of like just gone with it, but there have been instances where they've gone back in future updates and like forked out things that were not compliant with like the original vision of Ethereum or values of Ethereum network. At what point is that true for Bitcoin? If we had in the Taproot update something that was even less efficient or more destructive towards Bitcoin being a platform for global money or whatever you say it to be, would you go along with that?
Well, SegWit did this initially, right? This is more of a SegWit issue than a Taproot issue. The functionality increased dramatically with Taproot. It's both of them together, but it was a SegWit one that increased the, you know, block weight or whatever.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think it was sort of made for this, right? It was made. It was agreed to changes, and these are what the changes do. I think one of the learnings that we should take from it is the Taproot speedy trial was probably not the right approach. Going a little bit slower is, I think, my preferred approach with, you know, protocol level development. Because, you know, you need time to test these things out to see how it's going to be used.
Yeah.
And even then, you're not going to get a complete picture on how, you know, monkeys are going to start using this tool that's been delivered.
Do you like Covenants, then? And what do you think about Covenants in 2024?
I think it's great. I like the development. I really do. But I think that the consequences need to be better understood before we roll stuff out, especially when we're dealing with something as important as Bitcoin. So I'm a Bitcoin fatalist. I'm more conservative, but it sort of just is what it is.
You're like a laser-eyed Maxi that likes conscriptions. Like, you want to go slow and be conservative, but you also like the fact that you can like goof off.
Well, I think part of it's also just like these are historical processes, and like you know, I think the call it the cryptocurrency community as a cult analogy is also very, very relevant here, where, you know, for me, what I think makes Bitcoin the best cult and gives it the strongest religious narrative, right, is like, yes, I know you are correct that SegWit basically is like a little bit of and we're just going to add some additional data. Sure, it's maybe a little cheeky, but I think now that the cat's out the bag, if Bitcoin were to try to rewind it would lose such legitimacy. And for me, that's one of the things that really impairs Ethereum's claim to legitimacy. Like, there are many things that I think are done with Ethereum, but one of the most important is the DAO hack, is the DAO exploit, where you basically had a bunch of insiders, people connected with the project, who basically lost money because of a bug in the smart contract. And then they basically just said, okay, we want this to be decentralized, we want this to be permissionless, but right now we want our money back. But starting from now, we're gonna be fair, and we're not gonna fuck up in the future. And I think this is why Ethereum sort of claim is decentralized is just one of the many reasons why it's bullshit. And so I think that this is, like, the cat is out the bag. I think Thomas is right that moving forward in the future, this will mean that we're much slower to adopt new things on the, new BIPs.
So you're anti-covenants.
I'm not anti-covenants. I mean, candidly, I'm a grug miner. Like, I'd be very simple man. I'd be.
You're like a Bitcoin Roman Catholic. I'm more of like a Bitcoin Episcopalian. Like, divorce sometimes.
Divorce sometimes, and you know, if you can't come to church all the time, that's fine. And like, maybe okay. So I forgot about confession. But no, I think I think
saints are so cool.
Yeah, like I think the other the important aspect of all this though is that if Bitcoin is basically, if we try to make some change, we try to undo some change that's already implemented, then we're no different than any one of these shitcoins. And I think it's really important for us to maintain our legitimacy and maintain this spiritual high ground, so to speak.
There is a big difference, right? And it's the foundations of Bitcoin, mm-hmm. And the UTXO set and the history and like the decentralized properties, all that stuff. And I think the thing that causes people the anxiety that leads to some of these really awful debates that are on the wrong forums, open format on Twitter, or the listserv, or behind closed doors, whatever, is sort of whether or not we're able to move forward with stuff that people want to develop while we're protecting the the foundation, the first principles of Bitcoin, and that's going to be a continuing shit show. It's just that is literally the design of Bitcoin, where this is always an ongoing fight.
Yeah. And I think related to this, one of the really hard parts about this fight in particular, especially as you alluded to earlier, like, we want to make sure that, say people all over the world can hold their coins on chain and potentially move coins on chain and not wanting that to become prohibitively expensive. Related to this, on the other hand, there are some strong financial incentives in the form of, crypto VCs who are basically trying to fund projects, that are, they basically are in a way sort of subsidized by fund manager economics, where they basically, people are really trying to push some things, and there's like a strong sort of financial base there, whereas sort of the via negativa approach of some maxis who are basically saying, no, not on this chain. I find myself amenable to the latter camp, and I think this is one of the things that, say, with, and I don't want to get too much into any specifics of any of these one things, but say like with DriveChain, I think the fact that venture...
Carefully, sponsor the show.
I think the fact that VC funding was raised is one thing that makes it harder for me to get behind. Like, forget about sort of the individual technical aspects of the proposal, but raising VC funding is certainly, alarm bells go off for me at least.
Really?
When we're talking about making a protocol change to Bitcoin.
We had this chat. Like, Paul was kind enough to come into to PubKey and do a really great event. We actually completely borked the audio, which I am devastated about, because I thought we dove into some really interesting topics around drive chains. But yeah, I think the incentives and the motives matter. When you raise VC capital, what is the expected return that is sort of being put out there? And that's not something we have a ton of clarity on. I would say also for Ocean Pool, right? Like, mining pool economics for commercial viability is,
why did they raise $7 million? And I should have asked Bob that when I had him on the show.
It's because it's all seven, the holy number.
Well, it was like 6.3 million.
Three.
It was like 6.66, but
I'm rounding up. But like, why?
So you have zero fees on a pool that is inherently going to withhold some value that miners, individual miners, pool constituents, whatever, would like to get, right? So if you say we're going to censor some of the highest value Bitcoin transactions, it's 0% for now. I think it escalates as it goes. But as we've seen with other large mining pools like Foundry piping into Genesis, the Binance pool piping into their OTC desk, it's about locking in, customers and clients to use other services. And I think that that still exists for most mining pools when they have ASIC, you know, trading desks, you know, derivatives, hash rate derivatives, stuff like that. So it'll be interesting to see how Ocean evolves if it's a for-profit enterprise, right? They raised capital. Yeah. It could be something more philanthropic and ideological, which is okay too. Like you have a set of investors that do make those bets from time to time because the benefit to the broader ecosystem, you know, makes sense and is accretive in other areas.
Yeah.
So maybe it's that. I don't know though. That's a question for Ocean that I would love to ask.
We should dig into it. Real quick segue back to Ethereum stuff. Proposer builder separation. That's like the 2023, 2024 critique, which we should definitely like delve into maybe on a different show. It's not even like the DAO being an issue anymore. It's like the whole foundation of how a transaction is propagated in Ethereum now is touched through so many different centralized entities. It's a huge issue. And even like people in Ethereum at this point are like, well, what's the point? It's just like not working. So there's a huge Ethereum unaligned camp right now that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it is one of the interesting things, say, about Spider Chain. And like, and honestly, Spider Chain was not even in my radar until listening to the Mining Pod, which, again, I don't want to, to gas you up too much or blow too much smoke up your ass. But, you know, really, it is at the point now where I think with some of the recent episodes you've done, especially around, say, like the US-BTC HUD-A merger, like it feels like it's increasingly required listening. The Adam Sullivan CoreSci episode is another perfect example. But with Spider Chains, this was not on my radar until I listened to this pod. And it is interesting that where you basically have someone who's potentially made DriveChain kind of obsolete in a way where you can have this functionality without necessarily needing to go and make BIPs, you know, BIP changes, which I think this is again example, like this is out here now. This potentially is going to be very attractive for folks who are considering, you know, maybe they're feeling malaise about the Ethereum project. They're having some issues with the Ethereum project. This would be, you know, a very interesting case study in the next 12 months to see, do people move over to Bitcoin? Now, I think Arthur Hayes has generally been right, in my opinion, where he basically says the main issue with Ethereum is you can either be a smart contract platform or sound money. Trying to have both, like the two are at odds with each other, especially, you know, when ETH was pushing the ultra sound money thing because of their deflationary supply curve, supply schedule. But
you said you wanted the bar ambience.
Oh, I like bar ambience.
Sorry. Hopefully the audio comes out okay.
But yeah, it's interesting, like with that, you know, basically talking about burning ETH just so that you can have this like
truth
ultrasound
is going
money
right through this issue.
I'm trying to power just through. But at the same time, like, the, you know, ostensibly the whole point of ETH was to be this world's computer, was to kind of have all this the smart contract functionality. So it'll be interesting to see now that if folks be salty with ETH, if they come back over, it'll be really interesting to see what like the lion's share of the Bitcoin narrative is 12 months from now. Will it just be the macro sound money camp, or will it be more of this kind of smart contract functionality being built on Bitcoin?
It's very difficult to serve two masters. And you also have Solana on the other side, right? So for, you know, sound money, immutability, and some of the decentralization attributes that Bitcoin has, Ethereum is always going to be chasing that. But now they also have Solana, like, nipping at their heels with some of the, smart contract functionality there. So I think that the Ethereum ecosystem is in a really precarious position right now with those two sort of, like, elements tearing it apart.
It's bearish because of the chart. It's not going up fast enough. Okay, let's finish up talking about next year predictions. I like to do this typically in January, but I got you guys now. I do a hash rate prediction for end of next year. So it'd be the end of 2024. Mm. Every single person last year was wrong by easily 75%.
So the last time I made a hash rate prediction, I was able to take some money off Galaxy's Austin Storms. This would have been awesome. Was it the 2022 year prediction? I think so. But anyway, I think right now, call it, we're at 500. I wonder if I think the max theoretical possible amount would be 1 zeta hash. I think if we don't hit 1 zeta hash by end of next year, it'll probably be in the year after. I'm going to go ahead and say 800.
800?
1250.
1250. See, everyone's going to blow over this year because it's gone up so much. Most people said 350 by end of this year, and or at 500 now?
I think there's a lot of capacity that's, you know, just like ripping to come online. Mm. I think there's a lot of inventory that's not plugged in. And if we get a real bull here, it's going to be kind of insane. I'd like to see a geographic distribution, and it's so hard to get this information, but yeah. I'd really like to see where this, you know, this torrent has come from. Is it yeah. South America? Is it Texas? Is it China plugging back in? Is it somebody else? You know, it'd be fascinating to see, you know, a better view into that, but you know, difficult.
New Hampshire. I think it's going to go under. I'm saying like 700 or so.
I think 750 would be a good line.
Yeah, 700. And I think it's because we're already seeing like the information for T21s and S21s come out, and they're still producing and building those right now. And so I could think a lot of the additional capacity was kind of sold out. I think there's like a lot of secondaries to be sold, but I think like
we're going to see some bullish price squeeze. This is bullshit, guys.
No, I think it's going to be a price squeeze. We didn't say ASIC prices. ASIC prices, where are ASIC prices? What does a S19 sell for in 1 year?
S19 sell for 1 year, back to $10 a T, I think.
Okay. So that's 4x-ish? It's like
what are you marking to market right now? You're marking to market 2.5?
I'm guessing. I have no idea.
Yeah. I like one of the issues, too, is that like the market's become, I think, a little more... I think the bid-ask, or in general, like the pricing for these ASICs, I feel like has gotten pretty volatile in the last month or so.
Yeah.
Just because, like, they, you know, before people were pricing in, like, max pain after the halving. Now there's a question, is this temporary pump? Is this long, like, you know, is this beginning of a bull market? Even if it is beginning of a bull market, you have the halving coming up now. I think if we, you know, inshallah, if bull market, $10 a T.
Okay. I take that.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Cool. Okay.
Maybe more.
Thomas, Drew, thanks for joining the Mining Pod. Appreciate you guys' time.
Thanks for having us. Pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Foxley.